this camp, to this retreat here. The first talk will be on the theme from Dharma to Prema. And then in this talk, course of the talk itself, I explain how we'll be going further. So, can we move to the next topic, please? So, from Dharma to Prema. Now, a rough translation of Dharma is morality, a translation of Prema is spirituality, but that is a very generic thing. You just have to look in a broader sense. First of all, Prema is also a Dharma. So, what do we actually mean when we say that we rise from Dharma to Prema? The word Dharma has many meanings. So, overall, the way I have taken this retreat is the morning class, the first class in the morning, will be philosophical and analytical, where we are discussing concepts. And the next two classes, which we have, they will be the second class in the morning as well as the class in the afternoon, they will be based on Ramayana pastimes where we can understand those principles through certain examples. So, here we will be discussing the concept of Dharma and how it relates to Prema. So, can you move it? So, now, first of all, when you say from Dharma to Prema, is Prema not our Dharma? Prema is also our Dharma. But Prema is Paradharma. So, the Paradharma means the Para is higher or transcendental. And this word Paradharma is used in the Srimad Bhagavatam, second chapter, first canto, sixth verse, where it said, Savai Pumsam Paro Dharmo Yato Bhaktya Dhokshate Ahaitukiya Pratimata Yatma Suprasidati. So it says that is the Paradharma by which the Supreme Lord is served without invocation, without interruption. And that Dharma, Yatma Suprasidati. The heart and soul become fully satisfied by such practice of devotion. So at this level, we offer unmotivated, uninterrupted devotion. That is actually prema. So, prema is dharma, but it is paradharma. It is the highest level of dharma. And that is what we aspire to achieve. And Krishna also talks about this in the Bhagavad Gita. In the conclusion, when he says, in 18.66, sarva dharman parityajya Mamekam sharanam raja aham tvam sarva papebhyo mokshayishyami maashucha. So he says sarva dharman parityajya, give up all dharmas and mamekam sharanam, this is surrender to me. So there are some Hindu commentators on the Bhagavad Gita, they just can't digest this verse. They say, how can God tell us to give up dharma? They say that probably when the Bhagavad Gita was written down over many generations, so one letter was left out. And they tried to change sarva dharman parityajya to sarva adharman parityajya. Sarva adharman parityajya mamekam sharanam. Give up all religion and surrender to Krishna. Yes, certainly we have to give up all religion. But why Krishna is saying sarva dharman parityajya? He is not asking us to give up. When he says to give up dharma, that does not mean he wants us to become adharmic. We'll discuss later technicalities of what Krishna means when he says sarva dharman parityajya. But essentially, what Krishna is telling here is Maam Ekam Sharanam Braj. That is the essential message. That surrender to me. Srila Prabhupada would say that even the hippies had practiced Sarva Dharman Parityajya. They had given up their duty to the family, society, career, nation. But they and not practicing Maam Ekam Sharanam Braj. They not surrendered to Krishna. Prabhupada taught them that. So the point of this is that Krishna is telling us to basically go from the ordinary lessons of the word dharma, which we'll discuss a little later on, to go to paradharma. So essentially, both Bhagavad Gita 18.66 and Bhagavatam 1.26, both are talking about the same theme, that we should rise to the level of paradharma. That is, we should rise to the level of prema. So there are many dharmas, and all those dharmas, they are meant ultimately to raise us to the level of paradharma. So if we look at the Bhagavad Gita itself, it starts with an ethical conflict for Arjuna. That he is caught between two duties. To understand that, let's look at some other meanings of the word dharma. Go ahead. Yeah. The dharma word has many meanings. There is a normal meaning which we use in the sense religion. So we say Hindu dharma, Christian dharma, Muslim dharma. There is a conversational sense in which we use the word dharma, which is one meaning. Another is as law. Law, or we could say duty. Law is usually today used in the sense of outer imposition or outer expectation. This is the law, you have to follow it. But there can also be inner law in terms of what we are expected to. That becomes duty. So law and duty, they are more or less similar. This is normal sense, this is your dharma, you should do it. You should not give it up. Then there is also, when Krishna says, I have come to establish dharma, dharma sansthapanarthaya, sambhavami yugeyuge. When he says, what does it mean? He has come to establish law and order. Now, normally we say that police are, some riots are broken up somewhere. They say the law and order has to be restored. So law and order, normally we often use the words simultaneously. But law is meant to establish order. So order is something which is, say everything is going on in an orderly, systematic way. That will happen when everybody is following whatever are the laws, whatever are the ways in which you should operate. So Krishna comes to establish order. And for establishing order, what does he do? Paritranaya sadhuna vinashaya chakshuta. That means those who are contributing to the order, he empowers them. And those who are disrupting the order, he disempowers them. So those who are contributing to the order means they are following the laws. They want to follow the laws. And those who want to disrupt the laws, Krishna disempowers them. So that is another meaning of the word. Dharma, that is order. Another meaning is nature. And Srila Prabhupada will often use the word dharma in this meaning. Nature means that which is natural for us. So in the introduction to the Bhagavad Gita, Srila Prabhupada explains that dharma means that without which a thing will not be that thing. To put it simply, that this is fire. If we say that this has no heat and this has no light, you say, how can it be fire? Fire is defined by heat and light. Water is defined by liquidity. So things have their innate nature. And it is that innate nature which makes a thing what it is. And Prabhupada uses the word dharma in that sense. Now this meaning of the word dharma as nature has two aspects to it. You know, we have our spiritual nature and we have our material nature. As part of our spiritual nature, we are souls, and it is natural for us as souls to love Krishna. And Srila Prabhupada primarily focuses on that. Every living being has an innate nature to love and to be loved. And this is what drives all our activities. We may acquire wealth, we may acquire education, we may acquire power. All these are because we want to become more lovable and we want to love and be loved. So this is our nature. So Prabhupada explained that our dharma is, in the innermost spiritual sense, it is to love and be loved. And Srila Prabhupada, the Bhagavad Gita introduction says that dharma is there and there is sanatana. Sanatana dharma is that which is our eternal nature. So to love and be loved is our nature. And this is what everyone in the world is doing. But everyone is not directing their nature towards an eternal object of love. So when we direct our desire, our longing to love and be loved towards Krishna, towards the supreme eternal object of love, then we rise to the level of sanatana. So the process of bhakti is to eventually practice Sanatana Dharma. So to make this, it will seem a little confusing, I try to make it a little simpler for the next slide, in terms of how this applies to us. So there are various meanings of the word dharma, but we can broadly classify them into three levels. So the paradharma is our goal. Dharma as our future goal. That means we all want to develop love for Krishna. So if we are at this level of consciousness, say at the material level of consciousness, at the spiritual level of consciousness, it will be natural for us to love Krishna. As we become more and more purified, we will naturally be attracted to Krishna. Lal Mala says, just as it is natural for iron filing to be attracted towards a magnet. Similarly, I am naturally attracted towards Vishnu. Nobody has taught me this. This is naturally what I have. So that is our goal. So in that sense, dharma, the dharma of prema. So dharma, when I'm talking about this word, you could envision dharma as a big circle where there are many meanings of the word dharma. And from that circle, if you consider like this, it's a pyramid which is moving upward, upward, upwards. And at the peak is prema. So from the bottom, we move upwards, upwards. By practice, by understanding and practicing our various dharmas, we want to raise our consciousness to come to the level of prema. So prema is also dharma, but prema is the culmination of dharma. And that is what we want to aspire for. Now, dharma is also the process to that goal. So for example, when we practice sadhana bhakti, so when we start, when we take initiation, we take certain vows, I'll chant 16 rounds, I follow the regular principles. Basically, when you practice sadhana bhakti, that is also our dhamma. Ye tu dharma amritam yathoktam paripasate shraddha mana mat parama bhaktaste trigunebhyah. In the last verse of the 12th chapter, 12.20, Krishna says that those who practice bhakti to me, this is they are practicing dharma amritam. They say this is the immortal dharma, this is the innate dharma of the soul. And yathoktam paripasate. Though as I have spoken this, when they practice it, but it doesn't say just practice it, they paripas it. They worship this dharma. They make it their heart and soul. Then, shraddha dhana mat parama. With great faith, they make me their ultimate goal. Bhaktaste divame priha. They are extremely dear to me. So even one who, it is not a Krishna love, only is pure devotees. Anyone who starts practicing bhakti also, Krishna considers them very dear. Because they're very rare souls. Manushyanam sahasreshu kashchin visiddhi. Tam visiddhanam kashchin maam vittatvata. Among thousands and thousands of people, few endeavor for spiritual life. And even among those who endeavor for knowing the truth, those who actually come understand Krishna to be the truth and start devoting themselves to it, they're very rare. So, this is the spiritual level of consciousness, which is the dharma which we want to attain. Then there is the sadhana, which we practice, which is primarily comprising of devotion activities that will raise our consciousness from here to there. Now, along with that, there is dharma also. It is not that devotees are only practicing sadhana bhakti. We also have our duties in this world. And those duties, when we do them, this helps to maintain order in our lives, in our society, in our family, in our job. We are practicing devotees. That means we want to go beyond material consciousness to spiritual consciousness. But during the process, we are living in this world. And we need to function in a way by which we maintain the order in our life so that we can practice spirituality. So dharma as present order maintainer. That is aparadharma. Aparadharma means we may have, you know, we have duties, our duties to our children, our duties to our parents, our duties to our spouses. They are also dharma and they are also important. So now when Krishna tells Arjuna, sarva dharman parityajya mam ekam sharanam vraja, give up all varieties of religion and just surrender to me. So what is he telling? Actually we have to look back. The Bhagavad Gita is in the sixth parva of the Mahabharata, which is called as the Bhishma parva. Before that is the parva which is called Udyoga parva. Udyoga parva means, Udyoga is actually activity or industrious activities. So in this Udyoga parva, two things are happening. One is that the Pandavas are striving for peace. They are trying to have various peace negotiations. And secondly, they are also making alliances to prepare for war. Normally if an army is on the war field where the enemy is on the other side, then the army is operated by the strategy that and hope for the best and prepare for the worst. No army really wants to fight war because war involves bloodshed and destruction. So they hope for the best. The Pandavas are hoping that by peaceful means, by some negotiations, they could resolve the issue. But at the same time, they knew that it was unlikely that Duryodhana would mend his injuries. So they were also preparing for the worst. And at that time, while they are doing this, hoping for the best and preparing for the worst, there are discussions between especially Yudhishthira Maharaj and Krishna. And the same doubts that Arjuna expresses in the first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna expresses in the Udyoga Parva. And what is his doubt? He says that basically I have two duties. There is Kshatriya Dharma and there is this Kula Dharma. Kshatriya Dharma, in our life we play many roles. We have a role in an office as a professional, we have a role in a family as a family member, we may have a role in the broader community, in the society where we live. So we all have different roles. So like that, now the Pandavas, their conflict, which was also Arjuna's conflict in the first chapter of the Gita, was that as a Kshatriya, you know, if somebody is an aggressor, somebody has attacked them and somebody is acting adharmically, they have to fight and counter them. That is the Kshatriya Dharma. But there is also this Kula Dharma. Kula Dharma is that normally if we have our family, if we have our relatives, then we help them. You know, we basically our relatives, they comprise like a bigger family for us. And it's a normal human duty to help one's relatives. So, the Kula Dharma was, one should help one's relatives. How can one fight against one's relatives? How can one fight one's relatives to the point of death? And especially, how could he fight against his elders? So, Arjuna's Kula Dharma impelled him that I should not fight. But his Kshatriya Dharma was, I should fight. So, there is this conflict which is going on in Arjuna. And he had to resolve this conflict. So there are different kinds of conflicts that we go through in life. There is moral conflict and there is ethical conflict. So moral conflict means that we have two choices. One is moral, the other is immoral. Say, usually in a moral conflict, the choice is relatively, what is right and what is wrong is fairly clear. Say for example, if a doctor is treating a patient, say an elderly patient, and the relatives of that elderly patient who are going to inherit the property, the estate of that elderly patient after he dies, they come and tell, can you just do the treatment in such a way that his life is not prolonged? Now, it's a terrible thing to do. Now, but later than that, you are going to get this much and we will give this much. Now here, for the doctor, what is right and what is wrong is very clear. The doctor is going to protect the life of the patient. That is moral and professional duty of a doctor. But at that time, if the doctor succumbs, this is a moral conflict. One thing is right, the other is wrong. And one has to, basically one needs inner strength of character. One needs inner strength to resolve a moral conflict. One knows what is the right thing to do, but one is not able to do it. Duryodhana says this also, that janami satyam nachame pravrutti, janami dharmam nachame pravrutti, janami adharmam nachame nivrutti. So what he says is, I know what is dharma, but I don't feel attracted. And I know what is adharma, but I don't feel like giving it. So now, interestingly, Duryodhana, what he uses, his reasoning is, he's not saying, I am adharmic. When he has this discussion, this happens actually in the Udyoga Parva, only Krishna was a Shanti Dut. So he says that, okay, you are saying this is dharma, this is adharma. He says, okay, he says, but he's speaking to Krishna and he says, if I am naturally attracted to adharma and I am not attracted to dharma, that means the creator has made me this way. And because the creator has made me this way, I am acting according to my nature. Why are you criticizing me for acting according to which? So what Duryodhana conveniently misses out is that actually we have a lower nature and we have a higher nature. When we say something is natural for me, we cannot just justify any and every of our mistakes by saying it is natural for me. We'll talk about this lower and higher nature elaborately in our future sessions. But the point which I'm making here is that there is the concept of ethical conflict. And moral conflict. Moral conflict means what is right and what is wrong is clear enough. One just needs the strength of character to do the right thing. But there is, apart from moral conflict, there is ethical conflict. Ethical conflict means there are two choices and both of them have something to recommend. Both of them may be right. And at that time to decide which is more right, which is the best thing to do, that is not so easy.
So for example,
if somebody may say, I always speak the truth. Now speaking the truth is a good thing to do. But suppose, you say there are riots in the city, and there is a person who is being targeted by the rioters, and he is your friend, and he comes to your house, and you hide him in the corner of your house. And then the rioters come and they knock at the door. And they say, no, is he dead? Should we speak the truth at that day? Speaking truth is good. But in this case, there is another ethical principle in there. That is protecting life. So in this case, if one has to make a decision, one has to understand which is a higher moral principle. Speaking the truth is a moral principle. With protecting others' lives is also a moral principle. And when we have to choose between two moral principles, at that time one doesn't just need strength of character. One also needs clarity of intelligence. One needs to have a proper intelligence to understand which is the higher moral principle. So, an ethical crisis is actually a much more difficult to deal with. Of course, in this particular situation, it's simple. Protect the life of the person. So, now truthfulness is good. One of the consistent messages from the Mahabharata. Many people ask, why did the Pandavas also act immorally while killing the Kauravas? So, there are reasons for that. But a broad principle is, the Mahabharata says, that morality is not categorical. Morality is contextual. What does this mean? Categorical means that this is moral, this is immoral. This is one category, this is another category. So morality is not just categorical. Speaking the truth will always be moral and speaking a lie will always be immoral. Life is not as simple as that. So morality is not categorical. It is contextual. Contextual means speaking the truth in a normal situation will be moral. But if speaking the truth is going to cost the life of someone, then at that time the same activity will no longer fall in the category of the right thing, the moral thing. It will fall in the category of the immoral thing. So that's why morality is not categorical, it is contextual. Now why we are discussing all this is because morality is also one meaning of Dharma. And Arjuna, at the start of the Bhagavad Gita, was facing an ethical crisis. The ethical crisis was, should I do my duty as a Kshatriya, which is what I should be doing as a Kshatriya? Or should I do my duty as a member of my kula? As a Kuru Nandana, as a member of the Kuru dynasty. It is my duty to protect my dynasty. So both of these were his duties. So it was not that Arjuna was a coward who became fearful of fighting a war. Sometimes especially when some soldiers are drafted into the army by government fiat. Then they actually go into the army, but when they are about to fight, they get a terrible attack of nerves. I can't fight. How can I fight? How can I kill? What will happen to me? So there is simply fear of the loss of life. Of course, it's a natural human reaction and it's not to be condemned. But the point is, Arjuna was not facing a case of nerves or a fear of loss of life. Arjuna's problem was much deeper. His problem was that there is my Kshatriya Dharma and there is my Kula Dharma. So which should I be following? And he felt that, okay, if I Kshatriya following Kshatriya Dharma, I might get a kingdom. And I might rule the kingdom. But by ruling the kingdom, if I am losing my relatives, as he says that, Gunjiya Bhogan Udhir Pratiknaman. He says, the spoils of war will be tainted by the blood of my loved ones. And what is the use of the charity? With his reasoning, he felt that Nahi prapashyami mama pradya chokam chojanindriyana avapya bhuma vasattanam vrittam rajyam suranam api chadipatyam. He says, what to speak of this earthly kingdom? In 2.8, he says that even if I attain the heavens, what am I going to gain by it? Because that which is dear to me, my own relatives, my own dynasty, will all be lost to me. So Arjuna's crisis was that he had two roles, and the obligation that he had in those two roles, they were running contrary to each other. And he did not know what to do. So initially he felt that I should not fight. But then he realized that it was also not the right thing to do. So he became indecisive. And he said, I will not fight till I am able to resolve what I am doing. And if you see 2.7, which is the verse which Prabhupada will often quote, the key thing is, he says, Pruchami kaam dharma sammoodha chetaha. Karmanya dosho bhata swabhava. Pruchami kaam dharma sammoodha chetaha. Yashreyasya nishchitam bruhi tanme shishyaste ham shadhi maam kaam prapandam. He says, I surrender to you, shadhi, I become your disciple, instruct me, shishyaste. What should you instruct me? Pruchami kaam dharma. I am asking you about what is karma. What is dharma? And what kind of dharma? Ye shreyasya, that which will lead to long-term good. So Arjuna is here asking, which dharma should I follow? What is the dharma for me right now? Which will lead to my long-term good. So in fact, not just the Bhagavad Gita, but the whole Mahabharata, every book, every scripture has a defining question to it, which animates the question. Ramayana, for example, we'll discuss more later. Ramayana's defining question is there any person with ideal character? And in answer to that, Narada tells Valmiki Rishi about Lord Ram. So the Mahabharata's defining question is, what is dharma? And all the incidents in the Mahabharata, they essentially illustrate understandings, partial understandings and misunderstandings about dharma. And the Bhagavad Gita is a very dramatic situation. The Bhagavad Gita is a conversation spoken in a very dramatic setting where a war is about to take place. And at that time, Arjuna is not sure about what is dharma is. Arjuna gets overwhelmed. That means, when he's asking what is dharma, he's not asking what I should do. No, he is asking on what basis should I be deciding what I should do. See, all of us have our own basis. For example, you decided to come for this retreat. Some other devotees may decide not to come for this retreat. Some other devotees may decide to go somewhere else. Some other people may decide to become devotees. Some other people may decide not to become devotees. So now all of us take decisions. And some of our decisions may be just impulsive. I felt like doing it. But we have certain dispositions. Our decisions grow from our dispositions. Disposition means basically our attitudes. Our worldview, our values, they determine our decisions. So Arjuna is not just asking a simple question. His question in 2.7 is not should I fight or should I not fight. It's very significant. Arjuna has come to the battlefield and he is about to decide I'll not fight. But when he surrenders to Krishna, he doesn't ask Krishna a simple question, should I fight or should I not fight? He's asking, what is dharma? And it is this question that makes the Bhagavad Gita universally relevant. Now, if just a soldier had got just a warrior had got a case of nerves and had not wanted to fight, and some other friend told him fight, now that would not have made a book immortal. What makes the Bhagavad Gita immortal is Arjuna is asking not just should I fight or not fight, he's asking what is dharma? And Krishna's answer is also very universal. Nowadays, there is so much religious violence in the world, violence in the name of religion. And there, especially in Islam, there is the concept of, by some interpretation of Islam, there is the concept of jihad, religious war against others. So, in the Western intellectual tradition, sometimes Islam and Hinduism are lumped together. Islam also calls for war, and primarily the book of Hinduism, that is also called for war. That's what people are. But actually, if we see, the Bhagavad Gita, it is not primarily a call for war. Because the Bhagavad Gita quickly moves beyond its battlefield setting. The battlefield setting is described in the first chapter. But after the second chapter, where Krishna tells Arjuna to fight, there are very, very few references to Krishna telling Arjuna to fight. In the at the end of the fourth chapter, once Krishna says, 4.22. Therefore, Arjuna should fight. Asmatam agyana sambhutam hrustam jnana sinamana chitvainam samshayam yogam atishto tishtamarata. He says, therefore, Arjuna, rise and fight. But here also it's very significant. Krishna Arjuna has put aside Gandhi Babu. And he's saying, Visrujya Sasha Ramchakam Shoka Sanvi Namasa. In 1.46 he said, put aside my bow. And he said, I cannot fight. He's filled with grief. And here in 4.42, when Krishna tells Arjuna to fight, he then tell him, pick up your Gandiva bow and fight. He says, actually, take the sword of knowledge. He says, Tasmat Ajnana Sambhutam Ritstam Jnanasi Natmana. With this Jnanasi, the sword of knowledge, what should you do? He says, with the sword of knowledge, Chittoena. Chitto, cut off, samshaya, doubt. The samshaya which has come from Ajnana, Ajnana Sambhutam. So when Krishna is calling for war also, what did he tell Arjuna? Use the sword of knowledge to cut off the ignorance that has arisen, the doubts which have arisen of ignorance, and then fight. So the Bhagavad Gita is not primarily a call for outer war. It is a call, if at all you want to say, for an inner war against ignorance. And ignorance which leads to indecision. And after that, there's only the 11th chapter where Krishna displays his Virata Rupa, in which he shows how all the warriors are killed. But practically after that 4th chapter reference, there is no reference anywhere in the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna tells Arjuna to fight. Of course, once in the 8th chapter, Krishna says, Tasmat Sarveshu Kaleshu Mam Anusmari Yudhich. Remember me and fight. But that is primarily, the whole focus is devotional. Remember me. Mai Arpita Mano Buddha. Become the intelligence and mind of devoted to me, you will come. So, in the focus of that verse also, you will come to me. Just do your duty. And this duty happens to be fighting. So, the point of the Bhagavad Gita is, it is, after this, even in the 18th chapter, when the Bhagavad Gita ends, Krishna doesn't give any call, Arjuna, now rise your weapons and fight. Krishna's discussion has gone to a far higher level than the immediate war. It has become Krishna. Nowadays, there is teachers who have experiential learning. That may be cheating the children of field trip or make them do certain things by which they can learn. So, Krishna is the ultimate experiential teacher, the ultimate expert in experiential learning. What does he do? He transforms a battlefield into a classroom. He transforms the battlefield into a classroom, and as the discussion progresses, by his presence and by his presentation, Krishna raises Arjuna far above the battlefield. And they discuss universal subjects at such a depth that few times before or after world history, the subjects have been discussed like that. And we see that in the response of Arjuna also, after Krishna completes the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna does not ask Arjuna, okay, are you ready to fight now? What does Krishna ask Arjuna? Kachide tachutam partha, taye kagrena chetasa, kachida jnana sammoha, prashtaste dhananjaya. Have you heard it intimately? The yoga commentators of the Bhagavad Gita, they say that here the word is used, kachit eta chuttam partha koi eka grena chetasa. So in yoga, in the analysis of yoga, given by Patanjali, ekagata is a state of consciousness just before samadhi. So have you attained the state near samadhi? That's what Krishna is asking Arjuna. Have you become absorbed? And therefore, has your ignorance been destroyed? Have your doubts been dissipated? He's not asking, do you fight or not? And Arjuna's response is also what? Nashto mohasmute labdhata prasadana yanchita sitosvira sandeha karishye vachinandava. I will do your will. So what Krishna's will is, that will vary according to time and circumstances. The Bhagavad Gita message is not to fight. The Bhagavad Gita message is that to do the divine will, to surrender to God. So when Krishna tells Arjuna, sarvadharmaan prithijamamekam sharanam jaya, give up all the ideas of religion. That does not mean that he is telling Arjuna, become adharmic. It does not mean neglect your dharma. So Krishna tells Arjuna, okay, you have your kshatriya dharma, you have your kula dharma. And you are wondering which one to choose. So Krishna tells that give up all your conceptions of dharma and do that activity which will enable you to do mama ekam charanam vrija. So in the case of Arjuna, for him the way to surrender to Krishna was by doing his kshatriya dharma. By fighting the war. That's why he fought the war. So, just go ahead and explain this a little bit more. Yeah. So, from dharma to prema, when we say, we want to go to the paradharma of prema. And this does not mean that we neglect the paradharma. In Arjuna's case, his aparadharma was as a kshatriya and as a member of the Yadukul. So in the specific case of the war, what happened is, for him, choosing kshatriya dharma was the way to practice bhakti. Choosing kshatriya dharma was the way he would become elevated. And there is aparadharma and there is sadhana dharma. Sadhana dharma means that we have a sadhana bhakti. So aparadharma when we practice, that also elevates us. It is not that only our practice of bhakti elevates us. Our practice of bhakti is definitely vital, but it is our practice of aparadharma, our worldly duties, they also purify us. How they purify us, we will discuss a little later. Krishna Prabhupada, at one level, he always talked about how we should practice devotional service. Krishna Prabhupada is also expert in inspiring people to practice devotional service in various ways. So sometimes people have the idea that I have to practice bhakti means I have to give up everything else. That's not the understanding of bhakti. Bhakti means everything else in our life is connected with Krishna. It is not that we give up everything else for Krishna. We give everything that we have, we connect with Krishna. So now it's interesting, Krishna tells in the Bhagavad Gita in 2.13 that you are not the body. And yet, immediately in the next verse, 2.14, what is he telling? Tamstikshaso Bharata. Matra sarshastu kaunte shitoshasu dukkada agamapayu nityas tamstikshaso Bharata. So, normally tolerate, that's what Krishna said. But significantly, he uses two names for Arjuna. One is Bharata and the other is Kaunte. And both are related with the body. Just now Krishna told Arjuna, you are not the body. And immediately said, you are the son of Kunti and you are a descendant in the Bharata dynasty. So what is going on here? At one level Krishna is saying, you are not the body, and then he is referring to Arjuna based on the body. The point is that although we may intellectually understand I am not the body, we are still living in the body. And we have to act according to the body, body connection, the body disposition, the body nature. So the Bhagavad Gita's mood is, yes, Arjuna, acting at a spiritual level is not easy. But you are an illustrious person. You are born an illustrious family. Therefore, because you are son of Kunti, you can do something that is difficult. What is that? Tolerate material ups and downs. Tolerate material pleasure and pain. You are in a glorious dynasty. You can therefore tolerate. Srila Prabhupada would also do this. You know, he would dote whatever would be people's conditional identity in devotional service. So, for example, when he came to India with his Western disciples, in the early days, when he was preaching in India, he would say, the Bhagavad Gita is a sacred book which has come from India. And yet, to teach Bhagavad Gita in India, I have to bring people from America. He says, what are you doing? Prabhupada, what are you doing? He said that, you come, you study the Bhagavad Gita, you teach the Bhagavad Gita. The whole world is the market for you. And one time Prabhupada was addressing a gathering of nationalists. He said that Prabhupada was basically interested in inspiring people to practice bhakti, whatever be their conceptions. So he said that, no, you Indians, you are afraid, or you are lamenting even now, that when India was partitioned, India lost Pakistan. Pakistan was a part of our country, but we lost Pakistan. He says that if you study the Bhagavad Gita, if you teach the Bhagavad Gita, the whole world will become Hindustan. What does become Pakistan? The whole world will start practicing Bhakti. So they become very fired up. Yes, we should do this. And same to Prabhupada, when he was organizing the big Pandal festival, and primary devotees assisting him were Americans. And the American devotees in India had a lot of difficulty. First of all, language itself was difficult. And then the America things happened much more professionally. And in India, nothing seemed to be happening. So they were getting disheartened. And Prabhupada told them, you should do a big festival, Pandal festival. And they said, Prabhupada, you know, we are not able to get permission to get water in our temple. You are asking us to hold a big festival. So how can we do that? So Prabhupada said, you know, Indians admire Americans as being very wonderful people. They can do all wonderful things. So you are in India now. He says, what is the use of your being Americans if you can't do something wonderful for us?
So
The idea is, Prabhupada, other contexts may say that you are not an Indian or you are not American. But when we are practicing bhakti, intellectually we understand the ultimate goal, I have to go transcend the body identity. But right now, I have body identity. So what I should do is, whatever emotions are there associated with the body identity, I harmonize them with the devotional emotions. And then I can move onwards towards Krishna. So in this way, we move it. This way, aparadharma is inferior, but it is not unimportant. Aparadharma, when we consider compare with paradharma, yes, it is inferior. That is, so para means transcendental, apara means non-transcendental. But just because something is inferior does not mean it is not important. It is also important. We have to do our aparadharma. And by doing this aparadharma, we actually move onwards in becoming more and more dharmic. The Bhagavad Gita uses the word dharma in many ways. It talks of kula dharma, it talks of jati dharma, it talks of swadharma. Swadharma means kshatriya. Kshatriya has a swadharma for kshatriya. Brahmana has a dharma for brahmana. Like that. So it uses many of the word dharma in all these contexts. And inferior does not mean it should be neglected. Inferior means it should be harmonized with the superior. So, Arjuna had to practice Kshatriya Dharma, but he practiced Kshatriya Dharma in a way that he could practice his bhakti also. So, that is an art which we all have to learn individually and apply individually. Now, move to the next slide. So, how do we learn about Dharma? So, Ramayana display, this is from Dharma to Prema is our journey here in this session, in this retreat. So, from the Ramayana, we learn both Aparadharma and Paradharma. How is that? At one level, Ramayana is essentially a family drama, isn't it? It's a family story. How there is a conspiracy between, how there is intrigue and conspiracy among co-wives, and how there is reconciliation among brothers. So it's essentially, the Ramayana is family centered. It talks about aparadharma, what is the duty of a son to a father, what is the duty of a wife to a husband, what is the duty of a brother to another brother. So all these duties it talks about, so it's aparadharma. At the same time, it is not just aparadharma. Because the central character is Rama, and he is the Supreme Lord. And relating with the Supreme Lord is the essence of Paradharma. So the Ramayana in that sense can be understood at both levels. It can be understood from the Ramayana, we can learn principles of Paradharma, of how we can act in our duties in this world. And we can also learn principles of Paradharma, because we learn about how we can relate with the Lord. And the Madhuri Kadambini is a book by Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur, which is basically an elaboration of certain sections of the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu is a book which is a guidebook on sadhana bhakti. And that book is further elaborated by some themes of that book are elaborated by Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur and Madhuri Kadambini. So Madhuri Kadambini teaches about sadhana dharma. So it is that paradharma is our goal. Paradharma is our goal, sadhana dharma is our process towards that goal. And aparadharma is what keeps things in order there so that we can progress towards that goal. So, for example, to take care of my body, that is also my dharma. Sometimes some devotees ask that, you know, actually, if everything happens by destiny, then if you fall sick also, if I fall sick also by destiny, so why should I take medicine? You may say like that. But actually, if we are going to depend, we'll talk a bit much more about destiny later in one of the sessions. But the point is, if you are going to think about destiny in that way, you can say that going to the through the trouble of going to a doctor, paying for medicine, and taking the treatment, that is also a destiny. So we cannot just take rest in one part. There is destiny, which is okay, I'm falling sick, but I have to focus on what is my duty. So the body, the tool is given to me, and I have to take care of my body. So there is dharma and there is karma. We discuss this something elaborately. But the point I'm making is, if I don't take care of my body, then I'm not doing my dharma at the bodily level. Then my body falls sick, then I cannot practice sadhana dharmas. Now I cannot chant, I cannot come to the temple, I cannot do various emotional activities. And then I cannot ascend towards the spiritual level. So the aparadharma maintains order and helps us progress towards the spiritual level by facilitating us in the practice of sadhana dharma. Another, the word dharma has many meanings. I'll conclude with one last meaning. That there is, we primarily There are six systems of philosophy in India, which are deriving from the Vedas. And the culmination is Vedanta. Vedanta is what Vyasadeva wrote in the Vedanta Sutra primarily. Now, one of the earlier sutras is Uttar Mimamsa, Purva Mimamsa and Uttar Mimamsa. So, Mimamsa Sutra comes from Jaimini, and that book, Jaimini Sutra, begins with the question, Atharto Dharma Jignyasa. This says, Vedanta Sutra begins with Atharto Brahma Jignyasa. Jaimini Sutra begins with Atharto Dharma Jignyasa. And therein, there are also various definitions of Dharma are explored. And one of the definitions of Dharma is, this is not transcendental, but it is that activity which increases sattva and decreases rajas and tamas. That is dharma. So dharma in a transcendental sense is that which helps us to develop love for Krishna. But in a material sense, that those activities which increase the sattva guna in us and which decrease the rajas and tamas guna, they comprise dharma. Now, the combination of sattva, rajas, tama, this will be different in different people. For example, it is not that a kshatriya has to give up all rajoguna. Kshatriya has to fight, that requires rajoguna. But kshatriya, if the kshatriya has only rajoguna, the kshatriya will just fight for the sake of power. It is the sattva guna which balances and makes sure the kshatriya fights for the cause of life. So the exact combination of sattva, rajas, tama will vary according to one's nature, one's varna. But whatever be our job, for example, somebody is very passionate field. If somebody is in whatever job, very passionate. But even within that job, which is very passionate, some people can do it relatively in sattva guna, some people can do it in rajoguna, some people can do it in tamo guna. Now sometimes some people are, some of us are, we are, some people are busy and they are productive. Some people are always running here and there, but they are actually not productive at all. So both people will be simply running here and there. It's like, for example, right now, say we are all sitting here. So, all of us are sitting. Now, some of us are sitting and in sattva guna. Some of us are sitting and in tamo guna. So externally, both look similar, but there's a world of difference. So like that, the same, even an activity which involves a lot of running around and doing a lot of things, if there is inner clarity, that is sattva guna. And if there is inner confusion, that is tamo guna. So in any activity that we do, if there is a proper quantity of sattva guna, even an activity which primarily requires passion, we can do it better when there is appropriate amount of sattva guna. So dharma also means that which enables us to increase the sattva in us, by which whatever we are doing, we can do it properly. And actually, the apara dharma that we do in our family relationships, in our professional obligations, in our social interactions, if there is a proper balance of sattva rajatama, then we can do those much more effectively. And that way, the order that we have in the world, that can be maintained much better. So, for example, relatively speaking, things in the developed countries, say Australia or America, the material necessities of life are taken care of much better. So, in India or other developing countries, things may not be taken care of so well. So, now this is basically, it's both individual and governmental responsibility. Individuals also have to act in a responsible way, the government also has to take a responsibility. Now, when this is done, when this is, for example, acting or having a proper governance, that is a dharma. That is for the, it is at one level the dharma of the citizen. Remember, I talked about two meanings of dharma: law and order. So, order is what the government sets up systems for, by which there is order maintained. And there are citizens who follow the law, by which that order is further sustained. So, it's cooperative. But when their material systems are set up properly, then the time in making material arrangements becomes less. Then we can have more time to do other things. Now, of course, if we are materialistic, we will do more material things only. And we will do self-indulgent and destructive things also. But the point is, if there is material order, then even spiritual life can be practiced better. Spiritual life is ultimately transcendental. It can be practiced whether there is material order or there is material disorder. But it is a material order, then spiritual life can be practiced more peacefully, with greater focus. And that applies in our human relationships also. So, what as a principle we can understand in different countries, the more we learn the principles of aparadharma, also we can have more peace, more calm, and more facility to focus on spiritual life. So, this is how we will learn about the principles of aparadharma and the principles of aparadharma in our future sessions. So, to summarize, we go back to the first thing. Our topic today was from dharma to prema. And we discuss firstly how prema is also dharma. And in that connection, we discuss paradharma and aparadharma. So paradharma is the nature of the soul to love and serve. And that is what Bhagavatam says is the highest dharma. And so dharma we could consider as a big circle. And within that circle, there are many meanings of the word dharma. And that is the highest meaning. So if you have a circle, how much a pyramid moves to the peak? The top of that is paradharma of prema. So prema is also dharma, but it is the highest dharma. And how does it relate to other dharmas? We discuss that. Right. We discuss the many meanings of the word dharma. Right. It can be religion, it is a law, it is duty, it is nature, it is order. All these different meanings apply in different contexts. They are all valid meanings of the word dharma. And by understanding these meanings, we can see at different contexts what is meant when the word dharma is used. Then we discuss further about the three these different meanings we classify the three levels. A dharma as the paradharma of prema, that is our goal. And to achieve that goal, we cannot just say, okay, I fall in love with Krishna today. It doesn't work like that. They have to purify us. For that, there is a process. That is the sadhana dharma which we follow. And while we are raising our consciousness from the material, raising our consciousness from the material to the spiritual level, still we have to live in the material world. And for living harmoniously here, there are certain principles that we follow. That is the aparadharma. So to raise to the right and spiritual level, we follow both aparadharma and the sadhana dharma, by which we can come to the level of the paradharma. So that's from dharma to prema. And then we discussed about aparadharma, that it is inferior but it is not unimportant, not to be neglected but it is to be harmonized with our paradharma. We discussed Arjuna's ethical conflict. The moral conflict is when one thing is right, other is wrong, but we just are too weak to do the right thing. Like say a doctor being told by the heirs of a patriarch that, you know, that we would like to get there, so we will give you a property also. So that is immoral thing. But there is ethical conflict when two things are right. And which is the most right thing in that situation? That is what would difficult to say. Like speaking truthfully and speaking falsely to protect the life of someone. The morality is not always categorical, it is contextual. So Arjuna had an ethical conflict. An ethical conflict doesn't just require moral strength to decide. Ethical conflict requires clarity of intelligence. And that clarity of intelligence is what is bestowed by Krishna and the Bhagavad Gita. So Arjuna then asks a simple question, should I fight or not? And Krishna also doesn't give a simple answer, just fight. Krishna, actually, Arjuna asks, what is dharma? And Krishna analyzes dharma at various levels. And his essential message is that not that you give up dharma, but rather you become harmonized with my will, surrender to me. And for that purpose, whatever dharma is appropriate, you follow that. So in that context, for Arjuna, the Kshatriya dharma was appropriate. And Arjuna also doesn't say that I will fight, he says, I will do your will. So the Bhagavad Gita's universality is because it is not just talking about a particular battle, it is talking about the universal questions about what are we meant to do, what is our duty. And then we discuss the decisions we make are based on our conceptions, our dispositions. And the Bhagavad Gita doesn't just simply tell us, do this, don't do this. It actually re-educates Arjuna's conceptions. And lastly we discussed about how the Ramayana displays both apara and paradharma. Because it is talking family relationships which are aparadharma, but because it's a family relationship centered on the Supreme Lord, then they are aparadharma also. And the Madhuri Kandani talks about sadhana dharma, of how, what are the obstacles in the practice bhakti, and how we can overcome those obstacles. So today, in the next two sessions, I will take some pastimes from the Ramayana, and we will be discussing some lessons from that pastime. Tomorrow morning, I will take one session on Madhuri Kandani. Should be like a philosophical session like we had today, now morning, where we discuss the various stages in bhakti and how we can navigate through those stages. And some principles of Madhuri Nandamani I'd also talk in the other classes. But mainly, our most focus would be on the Ramayana and the principles of Aparadharma and Paradharma that we can learn from the Ramayana. So thank you very much. Are there any questions or comments?
Oh, okay.
Yes, we have mic.
Thank you for the wonderful class. I was just thinking, you know, when we are talking to many youngsters and you know, they have, you know, how we are talking about the Aparadharma and that material life needs to be stabilized so it becomes easier for us to practice sadhana. So they are saying, oh yes, true, I understand that how work is important and what you explain is important, but I need to stabilize my material life at the moment. And that can take a few years before they can really start getting the work. How can we
advise? So sometimes in teaching young people, they may say, this bhakti is important, but first I have to stabilize my material life. And that may take a few years. After that, I'll practice bhakti. This notion that first I'll stabilize my material life, then I'll practice my spiritual life. This compartmentalizes things in an artificial way. It is not that, you know, for the next 5 years I'll be the body, then I'll become the soul. Even now, I am always the soul. And my existence is always, our present existence is always multidimensional. We are the soul, but we have mind and we have body. So if we understand the philosophy, we will understand that actually nourishing the soul cannot meet. We have to take care of our spiritual side. But there is also a valid principle that how much time we can invest in taking care of our spiritual life, not attending our spiritual life, that may vary according to time, place, and circumstances. So, there are two kinds of later. The later, which is the excuse for never. I'll do it later. And the later, which is an acknowledgement of the reality of the present. So, we cannot equate the two. See, one problem in today's mainstream society, mainstream, I would say Hindu society broadly, that it is many people equate dharma with aparadharma. That means they think that if I am doing my family duties, if I take care of my family, if I take care of raising my children, that itself is enough. I don't have to do anything more. So one extreme is that we reduce dharma only to aparadharma and think if I am doing this, I don't need to do anything more. And the other extreme, that is what has happened in our movement, maybe in the first generation, that it is to equate dharma only with paradharma and to neglect all aparadharma. So both are mystical. That means if somebody says that I will not care anything about anyone else and I will simply practice bhakti, well, that varies in time, place, circumstance. Whether one can actually sustain that level of bhakti, it doesn't work out like that for most people. We may have a spirit which we want to practice bhakti seriously, but then to sustain that lifelong is often not easy. So we need to have a balance of para and aparadharma. Now, in the case of say some young people who want to develop their career and they want to grow in their material life, that is important and that is not to be neglected. But most people, nobody can work for 24 hours a day. Nobody, even if they are however career ambitious they are, they all need some breaks, they all need some rejuvenation. And if bhakti is presented appropriately to them, then they see that actually bhakti doesn't take away my work time. Bhakti actually takes away my worry time. You know, when we have only a materialistic conception of life, then there is so much uncertainty, there is so much anxiety. This will go wrong, that will go wrong, that will go wrong. Now, if you look at our lives, is it that every morning, 7:30 to 8:30 is my worry time? We don't have like that. But worry is like a constant background noise that irritates and saps our energy. And if we understand that I have an indestructible spiritual side, and that actually Krishna is always there with me, the more we understand this, the more the worry goes down. Worries will not go away entirely. There will be some worries. But it's the magnitude of the worry, it substantially goes down. And even in our material life, if we are calmer, if we are more focused, we can be more productive. So rather than see our spiritual life as contradictory to our material life, we can see that both are complementary. And that requires guidance. So how one can practice bhakti in a way that one does not neglect one's material life? At the same time, it is not that for the sake of pursuing one's material life, one neglects one's spiritual life. So how to balance the two? One requires guidance and one requires often examples to see. There are many, if somebody is a student, it has happened to many students that after they became devotees, if they were guided properly, they actually become better students also. Because their academic performance, they now have more focused minds, their academic performance improves. It is not universally likely that a person who is an ordinary student will suddenly become a topper by becoming a devotee. That may not happen. But overall, it's not that bhakti leads to neglect of our material responsibility. So that is what one is doing if one has an incomplete understanding of bhakti. And now, as far as stabilizing one's material life is concerned, one has to honestly evaluate how much time can I spend on my material life. As I said, I can't work for 24 hours. So now in some situations, some people may say that, okay, here there is an association of devotees, but I have got a job somewhere else where I don't have association, but there I can earn more or I have better prospects for growing in my career. So maybe I'll go there for a few years, then I'll come back. Now, if somebody has to make a decision like that, one has to honestly evaluate. If I go away from the association of devotees, will I be able to practice my bhakti? And in what way can I maintain contact with devotees? So these are practical decisions which one has to take with guidance. But it's not that our practice of spiritual life should be stopped till we stabilize our material life. At one level, we can also say philosophically that there will never be stability in an absolute sense in material life. Now, waiting for stability in material life so that we can practice spiritual life is like waiting for the waves in an ocean to stop so that one can swim. The waves will never stop. So like that, you cannot have ever permanent stability in material life. But there is of course phases of relative stability and relative instability. So if there is some emergency, some crisis in family life or in our worldly duties, then fine. So for example, if a student has got exams coming, now every day the student may chant the japa in the morning, but on the day of exam, they chant after the exam. That's perfectly fine. If somebody has a severe family, regularly they come to the temple, but there is a family urgency, family pregnancy, they will not be able to come to the temple regularly. That does not mean that they have fallen into maya. That's what is required. So that sort of adjustment has to be done with using one's intelligence and taking guidance from mature devotees. We don't have to postpone our spiritual life for the sake of stability in material life. At the same time, we shouldn't think that I should focus entirely on spiritual life and not bother about my stability at the material level at all. No, there has to be a yukta ahara vihara. Krishna says balance, regulation. So that it's interesting, this verse 6.17, what does Krishna say? Yukta ahara vihara se yukta cheshyasya karmasu. Yukta sapna bodhasya yogo bhavati dukkha. So he said dukkha, the freedom from misery will come by the practice of yoga. Yogo bhavati. But when, that means at the spiritual level, when we rise to spiritual consciousness, we become free from misery. That raising of spiritual consciousness will happen by yoga. Yogo bhavati. But that yoga, for it to be practiced, yukta ahara vihara. There has to be regulation. Regulation in eating, regulation in recreation, regulation in work, regulation in sleeping. So with a regulated life at the material level, when we practice sadhana, when we practice yoga, then we transcend material business. So both are required. Regulation at the material level and connection through yoga. Then there is elevation and liberation from this. So with guidance, people can understand that people can be helped to find how they can practice spiritual life with a reasonable degree of seriousness, while also pursuing progress and stabilization in the material life. Is that answer the question? Thank you. Yes, dear.
So talking about the different types of dharma, three types which you mentioned, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur also writes in Jaivadharma, he classifies it in three different types. One he calls as the Nitya Dharma, which equals to Paradharma. But he also talks about Naimittika Dharma and Anitya Dharma. So why does he use the word dharma in that context for something is Anitya?
Okay. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur uses the word dharma in Jaivadharma to refer to three categories, Nitya Dharma, Aditya Dharma, and Naimittika Dharma, basically. So apart from Nitya, why does he use it as a characterization of dharma? Why does he use the word dharma with that which is not eternal? Actually, something may not be eternal, but still it may be natural in certain situations. Dharma, if you look at its Sanskrit, its common root is dhri, which sustains, that which sustains. So for all of us, we have a particular nature. Say, a kshatriya has a kshatriya, they want to manage, they want to lead, they want to do administration. Vaishya, they want to earn, that is their nature. So we could talk about nature from various perspectives. Modern psychology talks about, say, some people are introverts, some people are extroverts. So now for those who are introverts, there has to be a certain kind of lifestyle that sustains them in their function. Kshatriyas have to have a certain kind of lifestyle that sustains them in their function. So that which is natural for us, even if it is not eternal, if we more or less mold our life according to that, then even in this life we can function properly. And to a large extent, we in today's culture, where many people choose careers based primarily on what will give the maximum earning or what is the most glamorized in society. When people choose careers that way, it leads to a lot of a lack of job satisfaction because people are in incompatible jobs. So what is happening there is that they have a particular nature. And Bhagavad Gita talks about two things. There is swabhava and there is swakarma. Swabhava is one's nature and swakarma is one's activity, one's prescribed, one's natural activity. So our swakarma should match with our swabhava. So we should be in a profession or occupation which is more or less matching with our disposition. So when we have that, then there is at a material level also relative satisfaction. Material level there cannot be complete satisfaction. But in material level there can be dissatisfaction and there can be utter disorder. So material level also, if a person is in a very incompatible situation materially, it can lead to a lot of misery. So when we talk about anitya dharma, that means it may not be eternal. So a person is kshatriya, the soul is not a kshatriya. That person may be a brahman in the next life or maybe something else in a different life. But in this life, in this situation, that is the basic nature of the person. And one needs to work according to that. So even that which is not eternal, there can be dharma associated with that also. And to the extent one understands and harmonizes with that dharma, to the extent one can live peacefully and productively. Not in a spiritual sense, but in a material sense. Does that address your question? Thank you. Any other questions? Yes.
When you mentioned the balance of three modes of nature, that we need to have some more of sattva and rajas, is tamas really helpful?
Okay.
Or should we take it out?
Okay. So now, sattva, rajas, tamas, we say there is balance of three modes is required. Now, is tamas really necessary? Actually, all these three, they comprise material nature. So, Krishna says material nature is comprised of these three things. So, sattva, rajastama, we can consider them in terms of what they are associated with. Sattva is associated with maintenance. Rajas is associated with creation. Tamas is associated with destruction. Now, if you look at the routine course of life, maintenance of things is important. But there are situations when creation is also required. There are situations when destruction is also required. So, now the problem comes that when maintenance is required, you destroy things. So, for example, if I have an old habit, which is not a very healthy habit, I want to destroy it. So, destruction of any form, that involves a certain amount of tamas. But the point is, it is more important for me to sustain whatever good habits I have. That is why which I will grow. And sometimes I will develop good habits, new habits. That requires rajas. See, doing anything new requires rajas. We shouldn't stereotype that all tamoguni activity is bad. See, when we sleep, sleeping is associated with tamoguna. Now, sleep at one level, what does it do? Actually, we do nothing in sleep. You know, in modern science and the philosophy of science, sleep is a big mystery. Why it is that, you know, why do we sleep basically? We may say that it is for bodily rest and restoration, but we could have had bodily rest and restoration without having to switch off our consciousness. Is it? Nowadays some people have some Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, somebody has. So those people are there at some time and then switch off. Suddenly go into some other world and talk with them, they're not there. So it's quite a disturbing thing to be there if somebody is like that. But actually, all of us in the daily course of life, 6 to 8 hours, we're not there only. We're here, suddenly we're not there. And this is just because it's a universal phenomena, does not make it any less unusual, less inexplicable. So the point is that actually during sleep, what happens, and there are many things that happen. Baldev Vidyabhushan and Vedanta Sutra commentary has a whole section on sleep and dreams. But suffice it to say, for our discussion, that at a biological level, there is the rejuvenation of the body. That means there is destruction of the tiredness. So, when we feel tired and we take a rest, you know what happens? The tiredness goes away. So that is constructive. Like I saw in the roads here in Australia, they repeatedly there was a power nap can save your life. So what is happening? Basically, that there is tiredness, and that tiredness is removed by resting. So, resting is a necessary biological activity, and what it does is it destroys exhaustion, it destroys tiredness. So, in this case, destructiveness is useful. The problem is not tamoguna itself, the problem is what it is directed towards. So, to label something as bad, it is to go into categorical judgments, categorical morality. Tamoguna is not bad, in certain contexts, tamoguna is essential. So I was once talking with one senior devotee. We had a long question answer session. So after that, he asked, "Oh, what is your plan now?" So now I am planning to surrender to the mode of ignorance. No, what did he say? Now I am planning to surrender to Krishna in the form of the mode of ignorance. So when we get rested, we get rejuvenated, we can serve Krishna better. So, to restore our energy, we shouldn't think of sleep simply as a waste of time. No. It's actually sleep is also an arrangement made by Krishna by which we get rested and we can serve Krishna better. So, that way, if we have inclusive vision, all the modes serve constructive purposes. But they have to be directed towards the purpose. Like some people say that violence is always bad. But no, Bhagavad Gita says violence also has its purpose. But violence is indiscriminate, it is bad. Similarly, tamoguna, when it is indiscriminate, that is bad. When there is wanted destruction, that is bad. But in certain situations, destruction is also essential for sustenance. And tamoguna serves that purpose. Does it answer your question? Thank you. Yes.
Thank you. You explained the various meanings of dharma. So dharma as a nature is perpetual, while as a religion law or order is Hanzian. So how should we understand the contextual application of these three in contrast with what something is perpetual?
Okay. Dharma as nature is perpetual. A dharma as religion or duty may not be, is contextual, it's not eternal. So how do we understand the relationship, interrelationship of all these?
Extrapolate the contextual effect of these three.
Okay, how do this affects the temporary aspects of dharma relate to the eternal aspect? Do they extrapolate? Not necessarily. That means it's not that somebody is a kshatriya in this world, then kshatriya in the spiritual world. For that matter, somebody is a preacher in this world. There is no preaching in the spiritual world. So, our dharma in this world may not relate to the dharma in the spiritual world. Or our innate, we have a swarupa, which will be quite different from what it is here. At the same time, there is a process of purification that is universal. That means, if we see in Jatna Charitamrita, in the instructions of Sanatana Goswami, in chapter 20 of the Madhya Lila, 20 to 25 actually, also, but mainly chapter 20, to Rupa Goswami and Sanatana Goswami, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu describes the characteristics of the various rasas. And we usually think that, yes, the Madhura Rasa is the highest. And Shanta Rasa, it is like my backyard. We think like that. But actually, the characteristics of Shanta Rasa is also described as two things. It is quite exalted. It is characterized by two things: complete detachment from matter and complete attachment to Krishna. That itself is a very exalted state. So, the basic process of purification to come to the platform of of attachment to Krishna and detachment from matter, that is common for everyone. Afterwards, in what form attachment to Krishna will specially manifest in my case, that may vary. That will be depending on the soul's innate disposition. So rather than worrying too much about what our swarupa is, like some devotees asked Jai Jai Maharaj, Maharaj, is our initiated name eternal? The name which we get. Is initiated, will that name eternal? Maharaj said, the Das part is eternal. So, we have to realize that the part that we are servants of Krishna, and how exactly we serve Krishna, that will vary. That will live on its own. So, our contextual dharma, to the extent that it is anukul to bhakti, we accept that. And to the extent that it is pratikul to bhakti, we keep a distance from it. So, without getting too much into the analysis of how this relates with that, in a specific one-to-one sense, we focus on that there is a path to be followed. So, the paradharma is a destination. And at that destination, our natural attraction to Krishna, in whatever form it is, that will be revealed. But the main thing right now is to rise from where we are to that level. And for that, whatever forms of dharma are unfold to us, those we accept and we raise our consciousness accordingly. Does it answer your question?
Last question, and then we'll adjourn for a short break.
Okay. Yes, please.
Please hold on to your questions, because we will have an exclusive Q&A session as well. So yes, please hold on to all the burning questions. But for now, we'll have to come to a close after this question. Thank you.
Hare Krishna Prabhu, thank you so much for giving us your time. I'm really excited being here today. Look, I've asked this question many times to very different Prabhujis. I haven't had a satisfactory answer yet. So, I asked this question with sincere hope, because you've kept it, all the questions in such a simple manner that even I could understand it. So I'm hoping that I can get an answer to this one. During Bhagavad Gita, Arjun, the role of Arjun and Krishna over there has been explained as someone who does not understand his normal duties and is confused. And Arjun goes on and asks about a lot of questions related to his normal duties to Krishna, and Krishna explains it in very detail. Now, one basic question that I feel that Arjun hasn't asked in Bhagavad Gita is,
how do human actually come up to this earthy planet, you know, verse where it's been explained in very different whole Krishna consciousness so it's about and we have fallen souls and we come to this earth. And Arjun hasn't asked this question to Krishna at all, saying, how did we actually end up coming to this world? He asked about soul, he asked about, you know, why do people do what they do, but not a basic question of why and how do we come to this earth. And that question really has bothered me for a while, saying that's a very basic and natural question, saying, why is that we want to this earth? I'm not sure if I'll ask the question properly, but
so, how do we come to this world? How does soul come to this world? See, the Bhagavad Gita, in the 13th chapter, Krishna talks about Purusha, that is chapter called Purusha Prakriti Bhava Yoga, Akshetra Kshetra Bhava Yoga. There, in the 20th, 21st, 22nd verses, Krishna talks about this, that Prakriti Purusha Chaiva Vidyana Vivavati Vikaram Shukunam Chaiva Vidyana Prakriti Sambhava. कार्यकारण कर्तृत्व हेतु प्रकृति उच्यते पुरुष सुख दुखान भोक्तृत्व हेतु उच्यते पुरुष प्रतिस्थो ही भूते प्रकृति जानुणा कारण गुण संगोष से सदसत गुण जन्मसु सो हियर द फर्स्ट वर्स इज रेडी फॉर दिस दिस इज प्रकृति पुरुष चैव विद्धि अनादि भावपि प्रकृति एंड पुरुष नो दैट बोथ ऑफ देम आर इटर्नल And vikaram shivanam chaiva, the transformations that happen in this world, in cause of the, and the more that are there, vidhi prakriti sambhava, they are caused by prakriti. And then he says that whatever changes happen in this world, the changes happen in the field of nature, in prakriti, but the emotions that we experience in connection with those changes, that happen to the soul. And why does this happen? Purusha prakriti sthohi mumpe prakriti janguna. Because the soul is caught in matter. Prakriti sthohi. That's how the soul experiences its duality. So it's like, say, if say, now the T20 World Cup is going on. So now that World Cup is going on in India. Now somebody visited here in America, in Australia. But if they're watching the TV, now they're watching the TV and their whole, all their emotions get associated with that. But they may be here, but they may be jumping and laughing and holding their head and crying. So, all that is happening is some things are moving on the digital screen on the TV. Kare karana kartrutve hetum prakriti. So, within the digital circuitry of the computer, certain things, or the TV, certain changes are happening. Like that, certain changes are happening in material nature. But, purusha sukha dukkhana bhoktrutve hetum. Bhoktrutve, because they wanted to enjoy the cricket match, so they are watching it now. And the consciousness has gone into the cricket match, and that's why there is happiness and there is distress. Now, somebody else who is not watching the cricket match but is watching them. I says, what is all this? What is all these emotions you are going through? So, the whole panorama of emotions that we experience, that is because of consciousness is caught in matter. Now, in the purport of 13.20, both Baldev Vidyabhushan and Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, they explain that this Purusha and Prakriti, they are anadi and their bondage is also anadi. Anadi means beginningless. Now, anadi, that which has no beginning. Now, what does anadi or beginningless literally mean? That is something which we, within our conception of time, that is something which is difficult for us to understand. Now, this question often is, now how did the jiva fall from the spiritual world? This question often comes up. This is one of ISKCON devotees' favorite way to give themselves a headache. So, traditionally speaking, you see that Srila Prabhupada, he sometimes basically addresses the question by saying that he fell because of envy of Krishna. But that is generally what he would speak in his conversations. But in his written works, he reaches quite clearly that the soul never falls in the spiritual world. In the fourth canto, where the Kumaras, they curse Jayavijay, and Jayavijay fall over there. So, therefore, the conclusion is that no one ever falls in the spiritual world. So, now, these are two contradictory things. One is that it fell because of so and so, the other is that we nobody falls on the spiritual path. Now, traditionally, in Gaudiya Vaishnavism, as well as in the Vaishnava Sampradayas, the idea that the soul falls in the spiritual world has never been talked about. So, basically, our acharyas have focused on the point that the bondage is beginningless. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur first talked about the fall of the soul, not from the spiritual world, but from the Brahma Jyoti. At the Brahman, from the Brahman level, the soul can fall. But for as far as falling from the spiritual world is concerned, that is something which is not exclusively talked about either by the Shastras or by our acharyas. And Srila Prabhupada also did not insist on this. Srila Prabhupada basically, when he was asked the question 2 minutes, Prabhupada basically focused on not so much on, as you say, post-mortem. He focused more on the cure. So he gave the example that suppose there is a green bird who comes and sits on a tree. The green bird comes and sits on a green tree, and then the green fruit falls off. So now, what caused it? There are three possibilities. First is that, Now what happens is the green bird comes and sits on a tree, and then a fruit falls off, and then the green bird flies away. So now, there are three possibilities. One is that the bird is flying away and the fruits falling are unrelated events. The second is that because the bird came and sat on the tree, that affected the balance of the tree, and because of that, the fruit fell off. So the bird is coming on the tree, caused the fruit to fall off. And the third is that because the fruit fell off, the bird got alarmed and therefore the fruit flew off. Bird flew off. So now, which exactly happened? Prabhupada says that this cause-effect judging in this situation is very difficult over there. So when we talk about that which is beyond the arena of time, so whatever has happened in the arena beyond time, that is difficult for us to understand here. And that's why the soul by nature is eternal. And when the soul comes in the material world, we can analyze and understand what exactly the soul is doing and how the soul can become elevated and liberated. But how the soul comes to the material world, that involves talking about a point which is beyond time. And that is something which is difficult to answer. And this is a problem, if we want to focus on that as a problem. This is a problem not of any philosophy, it is a problem of the human capacity for thinking. Because any school of thought we take, even if you go into science, in science also everything came from the Big Bang. But what came before the Big Bang? There's a singularity. Where did the singularity come from? So that is the time when time started. Now whatever that means. So what was there before that? What do you mean by time starting? So the basic point is that when we go to origins, the human mind's capacity to function stops. And because we can't conceptualize things beyond time. So broadly speaking, there are different devotees who can hold different opinions. And some devotees try to give elaborate explanations of how the souls fall from the spiritual world. And some devotees say that actually the soul has been here, and Krishna's mercy is that just as there is variety in the spiritual world, that there are some devotees who are in Madhuri Ras, some devotees are in Shanta Ras, some devotees are in other. There are different devotees at different levels of intimacy in their relationship with Krishna. If there is variety in the spiritual world, that same variety also extends to the material world. And wherever we are, we can practice bhakti and we can become elevated and liberated. And whichever explanation we find convincing, we can accept that. So there are certain reasons given why the soul fell from the spiritual world. If you find that convincing, we can accept that. But it needn't be an imposition that this is the way it happened and this is the explanation for it. Because we may not find any explanation satisfactory. And we talk about humility in various context. For example, when you come in front of Krishna, bowing down in front of the deities is humility. Humility in an intellectual context means admitting that I don't know and I can't know. I don't know, anybody can say, because they may not know me. But
It is, there are certain questions which, for which I can't know. That's what has to be accepted. You know, any field of knowledge, if you see, even modern science, if you see, it focuses, all of science progresses by assuming that there are laws in nature. And by observing nature, we can understand those laws. And then we can tap those laws for redevelopment technology. But why those laws exist in the first place? Science just don't know that. They just don't know. So now, based on the presence of laws, there are three broad theories that are there in science. One is these laws came by chance. The other is that the likelihood of they coming by chance is very low. So they say there are parallel universes. And somehow in our universe, the laws came out right. And third, this is also basically, this is also not a very satisfactory explanation, because it is like, it is piling concept upon concept. To explain one concept, we pursue another concept, and then the third concept. So, to explain something in the universe, we postulate laws. And to explain the laws, we postulate alternate universes. So it is becoming like, to explain something, you need to postulate something which is far more unperceivable. So then third explanation is that these laws manifest the superintelligence of God. Now there are different scientists who take different explanations of it. Of course, we understand Maya, Dakshin, and all the things. The laws are under Krishna. But the point is, the human mind, or the human intelligence, wherever we say it, when it goes towards origins in any field of knowledge, there is a particular point where we need to accept axioms and move forward from there. So the question of origin, it is something which is not being discussed. In Vedanta Sutra, basically all many questions are exhaustively discussed. And there also the devotional commentary focuses on the point that the soul is, soul's existence in material world is anathi. That the soul is here, and by practicing dharma, the soul can become liberated. Okay, that is the question. Thank you very much. Shri Prabhupada ki jai.
Hare Krishna.